tell you about our work. So let me begin by acknowledging contributions by collaborators. This was initiated by Lynn Pissman during a visit a couple of years ago, 2 summers ago, I remember. And we engaged a postdoc, Qiming Wan at UBC, and Lynn and I, we co-supervised him. And then recently, we also involved an undergraduate student, William Lowe. And I went to Toronto to also speak to the biologists. Daryl David is a graduate student working with Tony Harris at the Cell and Systems Biology Department at Toronto. The bulk of the results that I'm going to present today will be work by Qiming Wan. So I'm going to talk about morphogenesis of the fruit fly. It's a very complex process, so I thought I would start with an overview of this. You've seen similar pictures, I think, once yesterday from Emmanuel's talk, and maybe once before. So what I'm interested in is toward the end of this process, you see now the head is forming, and there's a lot of activities going on. There are different segments now, and this would pull back and eventually fold it to form the gut. What I'm interested in is actually in this area here, which would form a sort of elliptic piece of tissue. It's taking shape. It's called amniocerosa. There it is. That's the elliptical tissue. And you will see the two edges, the epidermis, would somehow fold in and close in the whole thing. And the whole thing would grow shut. And in time, this would just grow very smoothly on the back of the fruit fly embryo, and you wouldn't see any wound. So that's the dorsal closure process that I'm interested in. The whole process takes about 10 to 12 hours, and this final stage is about 3 to 4 hours, and that's what I'm interested in.
Wait again.
Like
the last part when you said that that's how it closed?
It closes on itself. We call it dorsal closure. Dorsal meaning it's on the back.
Yeah, but when you said, like, pay attention to the middle part, how it extends and make the wrinkles.
Maybe show the movie once more.
Just show the movie.
Maybe the last part?
The whole thing, the last 3 hours.
Actually, I'm not sure how to accelerate. I'll just wait through. This I took from YouTube, by the way. So you can go and look.
Was it the Facebook page of the fly? <I'm sorry>.
So what I'm interested in is in this region, that would occur in this region. It's a epithelium. It's essentially just a monolayer of cells. The cells are very flat. They're scale-like, so they're called squamous, very thin. So it's essentially a two-dimensional piece of tissue. There it is. I will have a close-up view. You'll see what's happening inside as well. So that's how it closes in. Okay.
It's a membrane.
You follow?
No, it's it's just a monolayer of cells. All right, so this is a very simple outline for my talk. So essentially, I have three chunks here. First of all, I will describe the experimental observations and give my interpretation. And that raises a number of questions about what's really happening there. And then I'll introduce a very simple mathematical model with which we can try to answer those questions. That would be chunk number three. So that's a very simple outline. So let me get on right with number one, experimental observation. So here's the close-up view that I promised. You see a lot of interesting things. You see the individual cells are oscillating. You see individual cells are oscillating, and the whole tissue is also oscillating. And the cell boundaries are wrinkling at times. And then somehow the whole thing started to close in onto the cells. The whole tissue, okay, just by way of introducing a few names here, the whole tissue I call amniocerosa. And then at some point, you would start to see a very strong actin cable that encloses the whole tissue. It's a supracellular cable. And I will mention that as well. That figures in my story later on. We'll call it, sometimes I try to say the whole thing, but when I say AIS, I mean the amniocerosa, the AC meaning this overall cable enclosing the whole thing. I'll come back to this video later again. So biologists found it convenient to divide the process into three stages to describe different parts of the different episodes. So the first part is called the early stage. That's in this picture. That's at the beginning. It lasts about an hour. So what happens here is, if you look at this plot here, I have the cell radius, the size of a typical cell, representative cell, as a function of time. So in this process, you see the cell area basically oscillates. The cell expands, it contracts, without net loss of area. So in this process, there's no net contraction, really. So that's the early stage. And you get to the slow stage, things start to be shrinking slowly. So you see that the amplitude of the oscillation is being dampened eventually, one by one, or maybe some say in a wave, the cells are getting, the oscillations getting arrested throughout the tissue. The thing is now from one cycle to the next, there seems to be now a net loss of area. So that's the slow stage. Finally, you get to the fast stage. That's toward the very end. So the slow stage lasts over an hour. And then as you get to the fast stage, almost all the cells have stopped oscillation. So they would essentially be, each cell would essentially be just squeezing in continually like that. Yes?
So you're imaging into the plane. How do you know that cells are not getting in?
Those cells are very, they are very, very thin. So I will not be worried about volume conservation at all. Essentially.
But where does the volume go?
Well, there are two ways. First of all, because they start out very thin, if you shrink the area by half, the thickness would increase by only a bit. That's one thing. The other thing is you could have transported liquid through the membranes in this process. So.
Is there any motion of the cells out of perpendicular to the plane of the screen?
I figured that was your question.
They go in after they die. Dead cells would be buried and be absorbed into the under.
But so throughout this process, throughout the three images you've shown here, the cells are all remaining in the same plane?
More or less. Apoptosis is an important issue. I will mention that toward the end. But it wouldn't be accounted for in my model.
The cell numbers.
So in your model of 2D.
More or less. There are about over 200 cells. Yeah. 10% will die and disappear, maybe?
Oh, no, as this is happening.
In the whole process. Yes.
You said in the fast stage, the cells are no longer oscillating.
No.
Individually, but there are oscillations in that area.
This cell maybe is not that representative. Mm-hmm. I'm speaking in general terms, right? Not the whole thing is 100%. All right, so those are the three stages. I'll get on to the first stage first. Okay, what happens in this stage are the following. Let me show a few videos here. In this first video, I think it's actin that's being labeled. You will see not only the green, the boundary is being green, but also you see those kind of clusters or clouds of myosin moving around. One thing that's interesting that the biologists pointed out is that whenever a cloud appears in a cell, that corresponds with the contraction phase of the cell. And whenever it disappears, the cell would relax to the original size. So apparently there's a strong correlation, not surprisingly, between the oscillation of the cell and the presence of a myosin network inside. And similarly, our friends at Toronto, they labeled the actin network inside the cell, and this is just one cell. And you will see a similar trend. You will see the appearance of the network corresponding to the contraction of the cell. And this disappearance corresponds to the relaxation of the cell. And those are just still pictures telling the same story. Over here, you can actually point to the appearance of this. That corresponds to those boundaries being pulled in, apparently. And eventually, when this disappears or moves away, the whole thing relaxes. So that seems to be the most dominant feature.
Only actin.
I think it's filamentous. You mean that what's being labeled?
Yeah,
I think so. It's a network. So. And if you look more carefully or do quantitative measurements, you take one cell and you plot the cell radius. I think that's the cell radius is the dark line, and the myosin intensity is the red. There seems to be a negative correlation between the two. And if you look more closely in one cycle, you can actually point to a sort of a time lag. So the myosin would peak a short time before the cell actually contracts to the minimum area. Okay, that's another way of saying there seems to be a connection. Yes?
Well, it must have been made and destroyed then. That's very fast.
The network appears and disappears.
Yes, okay.
They assemble into a network, and then they disassemble. That seems to be
So this is not a total myosin concentration, but it's the concentration of myosin in a network.
That's right, concentration in the myosin in the network. Should be clear about that. And also, there seems to be a correlation between neighbors. Okay, you can imagine that when one cell contracts, that would pull the neighbors so that the neighbors would tend to expand and vice versa, right? So indeed, that's, but then again, one cell has a bunch of neighbors, and they cannot be all be expanding, right? If they're all expanding, then there's not enough area, not enough room. So there seems to be a correlation that says for certain periods, neighbors, though they're the areas of two neighbors, they, for short periods, they may be in phase, but for the most part, they are out of phase, they're end of phase. And you can compute a correlation, there is a time delay. So at zero time delay, this is from experimental data of Jerome Salone's experiment. At zero time delay, the two neighbors are mostly negatively correlated. And if you go out half a period, they're positively correlated. You go out a full period, once again, it's negative. What's puzzling about this data, however, is that as you increase the amount of time delay, there does not seem to be a decay in the correlation. That puzzled me. I don't have an explanation for that. As I said, the correlation is not perfect, so you actually have moments where you would see a ribbon, Nicole Gorfinkel called a ribbon. You would see a strain of cells that happen to be expanding at exactly the same time, and then they disappear, and the ribbon disappears. And then there are ribbons where the cells are, in this case, actually, I said it wrong. This red ribbon here is contracting, and this blue one is expanding at the same time. But those are very transient. So those are transient structures that would appear. Yeah?
How many cycles of correlation will you see before it starts to decay?
Let's see. So the period is about 4 to 5 minutes, and this process goes on for an hour. So.
And the oscillations persist for that entire time?
Yes, without any apparent decay in the amplitude.
Wow.
So that's my first question, actually. What's really causing this? Why does this tissue oscillate like that? I'm not talking about the evolutionary benefit that comes from this, but rather mechanically or chemically, what's really happening? What's driving this? That's a question. Whether this oscillation originates from the cell itself or from cell-cell coupling. So this is a big question that has been debated in biology, in the literature for some time. So they wonder whether the cell oscillation is autonomous or due to coupling. And finally, what is the possible role of the chemical signaling in this process? So those are questions we'll try to probe or even answer later on. Now moving on to my second stage, I showed this video to you before. Now I want you to see carefully. You will see that. During this process, as the whole tissue, the S tissue starts to contract, you will see that individual cells would contract at the same time as the whole tissue is contracting. And you will see that the contraction appears the contraction seems to be more severe near the corners, it's like the corners of the eye, it's called canthi, near the corners than in the middle. And let me finish this video first. And some people say, I'll go to the next, here's my list of observations. So I said, you will see that individual cells shrink and the whole tissue shrinks. The shrinkage appears more severe starting from the edges. It's more severe than in the middle. And also, you will see that the oscillation of the cells, more of the cells will stop oscillating. And some authors said this appears in a sort of a wave emanating from the edges toward the middle of the tissue. Others disputed that, so that's kind of not clear. And you also see that initially the cell edges are very wiggly, but toward the end they become quite taut. So that tells you something about the forcing that's appearing in the tissue. So the big question here is what's causing the contraction, right? So I think in recent years, there seems to be a convergence of opinion that this comes from some sort of a ratcheting mechanism. And there are two proposals, unfortunately, that's been put on the table of what's happening. The first one is so-called internal ratcheting due to Adam Martin and Guy Blanchard. Guy Blanchard, I've never met him, but I think he works actually here in Cambridge. So the picture, this cartoon is due to Martin. Basically, the idea here is the following. So from a large, when the cell is in the expanded state, it contracts because of the assembly of this ectomyosin network, right? That pulls the cell in because the stress fibers would hold on onto the spot junctions on the membrane and pull it back in. And that causes the cell edges to wrinkle, as you have seen, right? And then before this cell has a chance to go back somehow in the slow stage, as in contrast to the early stage, before the cell could expand back, somehow the edge would have to remodel so that those wrinkles or those loops will be taken out. And you end up with a straight cell edge that's shorter in length. That would not allow you to expand back to the original area. And then this could continue in the next cycle when, once again, there's another wave of ectomyosin that arrives inside, that appears inside. So that's the basic idea of this. And this is supported by two observations. That first one is the contraction coincides with the appearance of very strong ectomyosin network inside. So that does the pulling. And secondly, the cell boundaries, initially they were very wiggly, but toward the end, they become taut. So those are the evidence based on which this picture was proposed. And then the competing hypothesis has to do with the supracellular actin cable that I mentioned at the beginning. This is due to Jerome's law. So what you see is you imagine that there's this actin cable that appears to enclose the whole tissue, and this may work as sort of a purse string, right? The whole thing may be just clamping in and squeezing the whole tissue shut. So that's the basic idea of this proposal. And this is supported by, again, two pieces of evidence. The first one is a coincidence in time. The AC cable actually forms at about the start of the slow phase when the tissue starts to contract. And they also claim that the cells next to the cable, the oscillation gets arrested first. As I mentioned before, others saw different things. So this part is not really solid. But those are the ideas that that led to the proposal. So there are different cells here at different relative locations relative to the edge. And you see those authors claim that the arrest of the oscillation happened in different time. So which is right? Of course, the biologists went ahead and did knockout experiments. But the results are inconclusive, to put it mildly. I think it's hard for me to judge. They had different mutants. They used different drugs. And it's never a clear-cut 100% picture. So it's not clear to me what's going on. Maybe both are cooperative. Maybe both are there acting at the same time. And also, I wondered about, once again, the actual chemical and mechanical mechanism that's causing the actual contractions. Those are questions of interest to me. Now, let me get on to the final stage, the fast phase. Now, the most interesting or distinctive feature of the fast phase is that there is a pervasive and persistent ectomyosin network now covering the whole tissue. So there is a contrast between, so the top row here is for the early phase and the bottom row is for the fast phase. You will see that in the early phase, you would have the myosin foci, kind of condensates or aggregates of myosin. They appear and disappear in time, right? But as you get to the fast phase, there seems to be a gradual increase in this intensity. By the time you get to the fast phase, they are always there, and they are everywhere. Okay, so that causes contraction to happen just continuously in time, and also at a stronger rate, at a higher rate. So that seems to be the main main feature. And also, you notice that there is a great deal of difference in terms of the cell edges. There is a great deal of tension here than there. And there are a few things that I want to mention, but then eventually will not account for in my model. So there's something called Ziprin. So as the contraction happens, the two epidermis layers here on the top and the bottom, they get close. And then they sort of throw darts toward the opposite side, a filopodia. And they would catch the other side and pull the whole thing shut. So that's called Ziprin. So that's very important. And then there's the role of apoptosis. This was mentioned before. I think 10% of the cells eventually in the whole process die and drop out. That helps make room for the contraction. If you suppress that, dorsal closure does happen, but it happens more slowly. Okay, that's been observed.
Did they drop out?
No, they disappear inside. And there's another thing, that's another observation. So there seems to be active pushing in the tissue that's surrounding the annulus serosa. In other words, the surrounding tissues does not seem to be passively pulled in, but rather there seems to be active pushing as well. So that may be a contributing factor as well. But here's my simple summary, a mathematician's or engineer's summary or interpretation of biological observations in this process. I see a number of factors at work. So the most important or the interesting, most interesting to me is why should there be oscillation, periodic contraction at the beginning? And what's really, so also the actin cable, what role does the whole cable, the AC cable, have on this contraction process? And then there are three other factors that I said that I would not consider. So my goal is a modest one. I want to construct a simple enough model that would allow me to understand the persistent contraction at the beginning and also to probe the mechanisms for ratcheting. So that's basically what I'm up to. So that gets me to the second part of my talk. I want to build a simple mathematical model. And the things that I want to capture are, I want to capture oscillation. I want to probe contraction. And I neglected the other factors, as I said. So we took this geometric setup for the tissue. This was inspired by an earlier picture by Salong. So we have a collection of cells. Each is a hexagonal cell, has a hexagon. And on the boundary, we lay down passive elastic springs representing the cortical actin. And then in the apical surface, in the medial apical surface, we also have spokes connecting to a central point. Those spokes would be representing the actin network that's appearing in the medial apical surface. And we do not allow those to disappear. They're always there. So we ignore actin turnover, which actually does occur. Okay? Instead, we would want the myosin to periodically latch onto the network and then jump off. So we play the game with myosin. So myosin is really the way that we introduce the force. That would make all the difference. And this is different than what happened in Salon's previous model, where the contraction force is put in and specified. So of course, that would cause oscillation. And the actin cable was modeled before using just a force that's increasing in time. We will do those things differently. Now, this is the only slide, I believe, in my talk that has any equations on them. It's a simple set of equations. Okay. So as I said, the cells are actually very squat. So there's hardly any depth. So all the action is taking place on the apical surface. We define the motion of each node. The node can be a junction of three cells, like here, or the central node of each cell. The motion is governed by the total force, and then there is a friction factor. There's no inertia, of course. And the force here on each edge has two contributions. So there's a passive elastic contribution, and then there's an active contribution due to myosin here. Okay? This is due to the actin network that's underlying this. So that's the mechanical part of the model. And then the chemical part is a little shaky, I would say. So we really don't, at the time we started working on this, the summer of 2011, there's actually very little understanding of the chemistry that's controlling the process. So we had to invent quite a few things. Now we know a bit more. I'll get to that in a bit. So we ended up writing down simple equations like that. So we say the myosin will latch onto the actin network through two terms, or governed by two terms. The first one is there is some sort of signaling protein. We don't know what it is. I'll say more about that. So we just put it in there. If there is signaling, if there is signal, that would encourage the attachment of the myosin onto the actin network. So there is a on rate, and then there is an off rate that's proportional to the amount of myosin that's already on the network. And this turns out this on and off rate are very important to the predictions of the model. And for the off rate in particular, we have this Arrhenius type of dependence on the force. That's to code the well-known observation that whenever you have strong tension, that would discourage the detachment of myosin. Myosin motors can become stalled and get stuck on the filament. So that's that. And then now coming to the signal, we really had very little to go by. So we had a source, which is constant, and then we had constant consumption that's proportional to the amount of myosin that gets latched onto the network. So that's the simple model. For parameters, we tried to use as much as possible the information that's provided by experimentalists and previous modelers. So we had the viscosity, the friction constant. This is the modulus, and there's that's the factor in front of the myosin concentration. For the rate constants, there are some measurements. So K1 and K2 go into the off constant, the off rate for the myosin, and K plus is the on rate. So we have selected those numbers, and so off with the simulation. So early phase, you get oscillation. You do.
Your oscillator is built up by the motors and the signaling molecule, right?
That's right. Yeah. And this happens only in a certain region of the parameter space, of course. I'll get to that. So you do have oscillation. It just goes on and on forever. And if you look more closely, I'm plotting the cell area in blue and the myosin in red. There seems to be a antiphase correlation between the two, as seen before. And there is a period of about 4 to 5 minutes. That's no great triumph of the theory, because you can tune that by the on rate. That's how we determine the on rate. Okay, but it is interesting that you will see that the myosin, the myosin peak seems to precede the valley in the cell area. That's similar to what we've seen before, like here. So that feature seems to be there in the model as well. And also, you will see a correlation between the signal, which is now in this plot, that's the blue one, the blue curve. The signal seems to precede the myosin level in the cell through the oscillation as well. And then comes this question here. Is the cell oscillation due to what's happening inside each cell, or is it due to the interaction between the cells? Our model says it's the former. Okay, because we have done.
Is there any randomness in this simulation?
Of course. Oh, in the simulation, no. In the results, yes.
So.
I should take that back. I didn't mean this randomness. It's in the sense of really randomness. I mean it's not periodic. Right.
But there's no noise.
There's no noise
in your simulation.
No.
And there's no randomness in the initial conditions.
No.
So all of the seeming randomness in this result has to be some form of chaos.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It has to be. Yeah. That's my way of thinking of it. Yeah.
Right. So you are not describing oscillation in the signal.
No. No. We'll give it an initial kick, and then it goes off like that. But this depends on parameters.
Is there any randomness in the initial kick?
No. We applied a initial, so if you leave the myosin, if you set the myosin to zero, everybody's just sitting there, right? Nothing happens. And then we all of a sudden added some myosin on all the edges, and the whole thing just started jiggling.
Perfectly uniformly.
Uniformly. Okay.
If you did two cells, would it be nice oscillation?
I'm getting to that. Okay, this is analysis of a single cell. We can do that. So we leave out the mechanical coupling. We can do a very simple analysis of one cell system. And it turns out that whether you get steady state or oscillation or exponential growth depends on the two parameters, K1 and K2. They both go into the Arrhenius law of the off constant. So that seems to be critical. So what we found was, if we start within a parameter space, which would give rise to oscillation of a single cell, you go to the whole tissue, you would not get oscillation. Conversely, if you just ignore the black line here. It's really the pink line that's of importance here. So if you walk across this pink line to a parameter value that's inside the steady state region for a single cell, you get oscillation for the whole tissue. So therefore, based on our model at least, the oscillation does come from cell-cell interaction. So that's our answer to that question. And also now you can examine spatial correlation. Comes out to be, as you expect, there's very negative correlation with zero time lag, and there's half a period, a whole period, and this decays with the delay, and seems to be qualitatively consistent with the experiments. However, once again, it's puzzling how this correlation can continue unabated as you go.
Correlation between neighboring cells?
Neighboring cells.
Time correlation.
Sorry?
The time correlation of
it's the
neighboring cells?
That's right. You have a time delay delta t. So you take the cell at t, and this t plus minus, and you cross them, and you integrate over a fixed time period, and you do sort of a moving window averaging, and then you average all pairs within the whole tissue. That's the plot.
Is it now a time correlation or a spatial correlation to show? Because you say zero time lag, and then you plot the time lag. I get confused.
Okay, so the calculation is that. It's a time correlation. There is a delay of delta t. It's a time correlation. There is a delay of time t. And then I calculate this over all neighbors, averaged.
I understand that, but I still don't understand what you mean by zero time lag.
Okay, so by zero time lag, I'm saying I'm computing the correlation at the same time. This cell at this time, this cell at this time, they seem to be negatively correlated. But if I consider the area of this cell with the area of a neighbor after half a period, they would be positively correlated.
Did you look at the spatial relation in time between the dynamics of two cells?
Yeah,
he's just getting worried by the word zero time lag. Zero time lag refers to the center, the origin of that graph only. There is a negative peak at delta t equals zero, but it's a function of delta t.
I think you've got spatial correlation written, Jimmy, but then time is on the axis. So
that's right. Okay, that's confusing.
A little confusing.
That's right. Now you have clarified that for me. Thank you. Okay, so we do see the ribbons as well. They are very transient. They come and go as in experiments, although our geometry is simple. So you can identify the strain of cells that are contracting at the same time. If you started with a more randomized initial condition, this pattern would look more realistic, not really in a straight line. Let me.
Excuse me. Back to this anti-correlation with that's just with a neighbor, right?
Yeah.
The neighboring cell, but each cell has six neighbors. So which ones are anti-correlated and which, I mean, isn't there a little bit of a frustration there?
That's right. You cannot have them all be perfectly correlated. What we ended up doing is to take all the pairwise correlations or average all of them over the whole tissue. So it's really an overall.
Okay, so if you were to look at a spatial pattern of, some sort of blinking of, you know, contracting cells and so on, it wouldn't necessarily be a nice periodic array.
No, it wouldn't. You're right. There's a great deal of randomness. But on average, it's still true that cells, by and large, are negatively correlated. Now, let me get to what I consider to be the more interesting part of the model. So what's really happening with this ratcheting idea? So apparently, you need the pulling of the actin cable that we have, the actin-myosin network we have. But what about this remodeling on the edge? So we really agonized over this for a long time. And then we came across this paper written by McIntosh and co-authors. We came across this paper, which we grabbed as a straw. So this is an interesting paper. It talks about an in vitro system where you have a reconstituted actomyosin network system. You put them together, and gradually the actin would gather the myosin the other way. Sorry, gradually the myosin would form condensates, and then it would gather actin cables surrounding it, and then those foci would coalesce into larger pictures. And what's really underlying this process is the asymmetry in the reaction of an actin cable to compression and to tension. Okay, if you stretch an actin cable, nothing much happens, to a good extent. But if you compress it, the cable is very vulnerable to buckling. So in this picture, in their picture, what happens is if you have a myosin foci here, it grabs onto a piece of actin. If the actin is being compressed, it would wrinkle, and then it would buckle and forms a clump, and that gets bridged over by other actin, and therefore that loop is taken out. And this happens on a larger scale as well. And we thought that corresponded very closely to what Adam Martin had in mind when he said that the ratchet works by the remodeling of the cortical network. So we thought, wow, that must be the reason. That must be what's really happening here. But unfortunately, there's a slight mismatch of the time scale. So in Fred's system, the whole thing would assemble in a time scale of half an hour or 40 minutes, I believe. In our case, in our dorsal closure process, each cycle is about four to five minutes. Okay, so there's a slight difference in the time scale, so I'll get to that. But for the moment, we took this idea and we used it. We modeled the ratcheting by periodically, every time we reached the valley of an oscillation, we would shrink the resting length of the passive elastic spring so it, by 3% or 1%, so as to represent the fact that now the acting cortex has been shrunk by this loop and bridge process that I mentioned. So if you use that, indeed, you have contraction, of course. So the tissue would tend to contract. And this is to test the internal ratcheting. It seems to be working. And if you look at the whole area, so I'm plotting here, there's a dark line, which is the whole tissue area. And then I have two representative cells, one and two. They were oscillating happily before time zero. So that's the early phase. And then at time equal to zero, we kind of flip on this ratcheting mechanism to have the resting length shrink. And then indeed, the cell area comes down. The oscillation is gradually suppressed. And we also see that this suppression happens near the edge and then propagates to the middle. There's a bit of artifacting here because we fixed the edge, the kansai. So therefore, those cells appear artificially large because they're not allowed to move. Of course, you can vary this parameter here. So we have chosen, in this case, 3%, I think, in one cycle. If we do that, by the end of 80 minutes, that's what the experimenters consider to be the end of the slow phase, you would have achieved about a loss of the area about a half, and maybe half of the cells have stopped oscillating. So, but this is controlled by the magnitude of the ratcheting, of course. Now let me speed up a little bit. So if you now consider the AC ratcheting of the whole tissue, this turns out to be very ineffective. Okay, so you see the whole area drops about 10%. That's it. Each individual cell drops about 10%, and you cannot suppress the oscillation of each cell. Of course, you say, crank up the strength of the ratcheting, right? We did that, but it turns out that if you do not allow internal remodeling of the cell, just by pushing on it, the cells eventually, the structure would get destroyed. In our model, the cells would invert, so the internal node would jump out. So in reality, we interpret that as meaning that in reality, without internal modeling, just by squeezing on it, wouldn't do the trick. And OK, I'll skip that. We did not really rule out the AC ratcheting mechanism. Maybe the two are working together. One thing that AC ratcheting does is that it smooths the edge, as you can imagine. Of course, that makes the picture a little prettier. Get to the fast phase. We didn't know how to model it. We still don't. So what happened was we realized that our signaling model, our chemistry model, is too simple. It's too crude. It cannot naturally give rise to this gradual increase of the ectomyosin network. Okay? But that's absolutely necessary for the actual process. So what we ended up doing is we sort of cheated. So we realized that in our model, if you set the time derivatives to zero, the myosin would approach a constant, unless you allow the signal to grow somehow for external reasons, right? So we ended up with a constant amount of myosin as we get to the fast phase. So we need additional mechanism, which we did not have at the time of this model. So what we did was cheating by continuously shrinking the resting length. So to use the passive elasticity as a proxy to squeeze the tissue down. That does the job, but not in the right way, right? So as you get to the fast phase, you see that the area certainly shrinks down to about 10%. But as I say, we do not really have a good handle on the chemistry that's really happening toward the fast phase. I have a little bit now. So now this is supposed to show the triumph of the model, right? So it looks more or less OK. All right, I'll skip this. It takes a little while. But OK, so here's my summary. We have this very simple model. And then it seems to be successful in capturing the oscillation. And we posed an answer. We put forth an answer to the question of whether the oscillation is cell autonomous or not. We say it is not. Okay? And then we probed two ratcheting mechanisms. We say probably it's the internal ratcheting that's really doing the work. Okay? And finally, I emphasize this weakness in the model that we do not really have a good handle on this. But despite all this, the paper has appeared. And even more, the editor was kind enough to ask one of the reviewers, Nicole Gorfinkel, who did much of the experimental work, to write a commentary on this. But I thought we had higher standards, so we're not happy about this. So we say, so we recognize that there's a serious flaw in this. So can we do better than that? So we realize that in the slow phase, we don't really have internal trigger that tells the system that now the early phase has ended and the slow phase now is starting, right? There's no natural, we have to do that manually. Okay, that's one thing that's not right. And second thing is this ratcheting. We did that by shrinking the length on the edge. Fine, that's fine. But there is a mismatch in the time scale. So in reality, what I believe happens is that the actin network inside, the medial apical actin network, is continually getting stronger. So it grabs onto the edges and hold on to them so that there may be more than one cycle of time that's available for the cortical network to remodel itself. And in the fast phase, of course, we don't really know what to do. At that time, we looked in the literature. We can only gather just a little bit of evidence as to the chemistry that's controlling this whole process. Okay? So this group in Toronto identified this family of the PAR family of proteins with three members that seems to be at work. PAR6 and APKC, they almost always form a complex. There are really two players here. Apparently, Bazooka would work to promote contraction. It would work to fortify the network, whereas APKC seems to do the opposite. That's the situation at that time. So we went back to them. I went to Toronto. I spoke to the biologists. We developed new experiments to try to figure this out, and there are results. Now I'll just sketch them in 1 minute. Okay. So we wrote up the results, and we helped them with the interpretation. That's under review. So the main picture is this. So that's sort of the wiring diagram of what's happening here. So there are a few relationships here I want to mention. So there are two signaling molecules. There's APKC and there's Bazooka. Okay. Then there's a regulator of the actual myosin network. So this can be the Rho family of small protein that's doing that's enabling the formation of the actomyosin network. So what happens is there's a spatial relationship. When the actomyosin network appears, it recruits APKC. It draws the APKC onto the network, and once the APKC is in place, it draws the Bazooka onto the network. So there is this spatial correlation. That's number one. Then there is a chemical relationship. APKC is known to phosphorylate the network regulator, thereby causing the network to disassemble. Okay? So there is an inhibition of the APKC by phosphorylating the network, the regulator, that inhibits the network. On the other hand, when APKC comes into contact with Bazooka, Bazooka also gets phosphorylated by APKC. So what that means is there's potentially a competitive inhibition scenario here. If you have an abundance of Bazooka, that would consume so much APKC as to free up the network regulator to go and promote the network. Okay? So just by the ebb and flow of those species, you can imagine a situation where this the Bazooka would eventually grow, and you can have sort of a natural sequence of those phenomena. So that's being coded up. Thank you.
If you go back about three slides, you were showing this movie again of the real the embryo.
That's more than.
Oh, okay. Anyway, it seemed to show fairly large scale correlations, larger patches as I look at that are contracting together. You mentioned ribbons before, but they seem to actually be sort of larger two-dimensional patches of several cells.
You've got a good eye. You can autocorrelate by eye.
It's hard to tell.
I think it was. I don't know. It certainly looks that way to me.
You can show this.
I get
correlations.
Yeah, the correlations. The actual correlation says otherwise. Right. It says.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. There's no large scale correlations.
Okay, John, last question.
How your model is a perfect hexagonal lattice. How close is this to that? There's a lot of disorder.
Good question. We cannot model the wriggling, the ruffles on the
I'm just asking about the topology of the network. It's obviously not every cell has six neighbors. And I just wonder how big the departures from that are, if you made the effort to quantify that, and if you have any idea how that would affect your results.
I'm not sure I understood the question.
The difference
if you look at the real picture, it's not a hexagonally coordinated lattice.
Ah, okay, of course, yeah.
Most cells have six neighbors, but some have others.
Oh, okay, that's okay. Mine is a perfectly regular lattice, whereas in reality it's not.
Right, and this is not.
I don't have an answer. That's a good question.
Okay, I suggest we thank Jimmy again.